stronger kids. And stronger kids are our most important national good. That was the message back then.
Susan Fern Zubner is a professor of history at the University of Mary Washington. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. For months, companies and experts have been suggesting we hurry up and buy our Christmas gifts. Well, it's almost Judgment Day. Will they arrive in time? Erica Marciak is a professor of supply chain management at Old Dominion University. She says the pandemic is one thing, but our supply chain issues are another. We're importing almost everything these days, and it takes time for things to travel by land, sea, and air to get to our front stoop. Erica, we've all been warned to buy extra early this year due to supply disruptions, but how bad is it? Are late shoppers in trouble, do you think, at this point in the season?
Well, I think that late shoppers are always going to have some sorts of trouble simply because of the procrastination, but they should be able to still get items. It may not be their first choice, but I always say if you can be more creative, then you'll be more satisfied.
We've all seen the images of container ships waiting at sea, especially in California, to offload goods. Why exactly did that happen? We get that there's a backlog. We get that it's hard to solve. What led to it?
I would say COVID exacerbated a problem that we already had, in that we don't make a lot of stuff in the United States anymore. And so we buy a lot of items that have to be imported. And that's been increasing over the past decades.
Do you mean it increased even during the two-year pandemic?
So initially, when COVID hit, we stopped purchasing things because I think there was a lot of economic uncertainty. But at the same time, once we got over that initial gap in purchasing, we have just been buying on steroids since then. For example, in the past, let's say, year, buying and spending is 20% more than ever.
I totally get that. But I also feel like this is going to be super temporary and will even out. Is that what you and others in the supply chain economics field believe?
Even out is probably not what I would use. The COVID pandemic has certainly laid bare some of the problems that we have in the supply chain system. What my hope is that our infrastructure investments are going to be able to address those gaps moving forward, so that even if we continue to purchase more things from elsewhere, we'll have a more robust system to do that.
But help me understand our infrastructure problem. Isn't it just that temporarily we've got dozens of ships waiting with lots of goods that need to get on trucks and go across the country? Eventually, that's going to solve itself, right?
So what's happened over time is, particularly with COVID, the rest of the world, which made most of our stuff, had to stop making our stuff for a while. They had economic shutdowns. They had the areas that were making things for us weren't able to make things for us for a while.
Mostly China, or China and a lot of other places?
China and a lot of other places, but mostly okay. Asia. So when that initially happened, we were running short on things. Part of that was also because we changed our behavior patterns. Even the toilet paper scandals of last year, where we weren't actually missing toilet paper overall. We were just missing the kind of toilet paper that we used at home.
Oh, you mean we had an abundance of cheap, thin toilet paper meant for work?
Yes,
we did.
But
the rest of us wanted comfy, thick, expensive toilet paper?
Yes, or different sizing. Part of that was our changing behavior and consumption patterns. You suddenly were home and said, well, my goodness, I can't spend my money doing something fun outside, so let me spend my money getting something fun for home. So combined with that supply problem, meaning the rest of the world wasn't able to make stuff for a while, and the United States is just still continuing to buy more and more and more, those things we're buying have to come in to this country. And they come in through very small doors, small gateways, like a port. And so if we think about a port sort of like a tunnel or a gate, I might have a large amount of things on one side that needs to get through this tiny little doorway, this tiny little gateway. Our ports, for example, on the west coast of the United States, in Los Angeles or Long Beach, they process nearly 40% of what's coming into the United States from Asia in particular. And if they're getting flooded with more and more and more goods, the doorway hasn't gotten any bigger. It just means there's more stuff on the other side that needs to get through.
So why haven't more workers with more trucks and more offloading gear simply ramped it up, worked around the clock, and worked through the backlog? What's preventing that?
Some of that is labor shortages. We've been experiencing labor shortages throughout all sorts of jobs, and supply chain jobs are one of those. Just because, for example, the port of Long Beach or Los Angeles says, we're going to be open 24 hours a day. Just because they agree to be open 24 hours a day doesn't necessarily mean that the truckers are willing to arrive at 2 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night.
Do you think that we're poised for sort of a moonshot of transportation upgrade in the sense that we once went coast to coast with railroad building? We had the great building of the network of superhighways across America. We had going to the moon. Do you think we're on the brink of needing something akin to that in terms of our national infrastructure?
I certainly think we could use it, and I hope that it is arriving.
Where do we need it?
Unfortunately, we need it across all sorts of our transportation infrastructure. We need it in terms of our water, our ports. We need it in terms of our railroads. We need it in terms of our trucking. We need it in terms of our road investments. I live in a small town where what used to be a main street, just a regular main street, now has trucks on it that go from the port at one end of town to a port at another end of town. And that street gets incredibly congested, but it's also constrained because it has houses on either side. And so the only way to fix that congestion would be to either take away some of the housing or build a rather expensive bridge structure over it. That main street used to work a long time ago, but now there are more trucks on it and it doesn't work. And so we need those sorts of investments into building capacity for our transportation modes.
You know, business people are so innovative and imaginative. Do you think there may be lasting and unexpected consequences of the supply chain logjam, that there will be new ways of doing business that stick after people find workarounds?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we're seeing some of them already. When everything's working fine, you don't think of new ways to do stuff because everything's working fine. You start to get creative when things aren't working the way you want them to. So, for example, Ford manufactures vehicles, cars. It didn't previously manufacture its own semiconductor chips. Now, with the chip shortages, they just announced a recent deal where they're going to start making their own because they could not rely on getting them from somewhere else. Other things are that consumers, and especially small and mid-size companies, they don't have the deep pockets of the large retailers. And so they're coming up with different ways of sourcing. Maybe instead of bringing something in over from Asia via a rather time-consuming supply chain, I'm going to look for something that might be sourced closer to home in my region or nearby, something that would be able to substitute, but I don't have to concern myself with whether or not it's going to be delayed.
So you think the U.S. has already started manufacturing more goods or parts domestically, right?
I wouldn't say they're already doing it. I would say that COVID has provided an incentive to do so.
When it comes to actual holiday shopping, what are some of the goods that you've heard are most affected by the backlog? I mean, is it cars, toys, clothing?
Predominantly holiday goods that are impacted. Anything related to chips, computer chips, gaming consoles, laptops, phones, those sorts of things. Toys as well, mainly because most of those are made abroad and we're importing them. Books, when COVID hit, we started buying more books, physical hard copy books, and a lot of those aren't printed here. A lot of the clothing, accessories, and sportswear that are made, particularly in Asia, are going to run into some challenges. You'll still find it, but it may not be the exact brand or model that you want. Surprisingly, alcohol, even if it's locally made, it depends on other things. Like, we might make the wine in Virginia, but the bottle that we're putting it in may not be from Virginia. It may be from elsewhere.
What about you? Did even you worry a little bit when you heard there was going to be this port backup and maybe scarcity of toys or electronics this year?
I have a 13-year-old son who might like a certain game or a console. And I might say, well, we're not going to find that one this year at a price that I'm willing to pay. So let's see what else we can come up with as a substitute.
I forgot about that. Prices shot through the roof on a lot of these toys.
Very much so. And not just on toys, just about everything.
Yeah.
Now, I will say about inflation, some of the large companies have somewhat deeper pockets, and they are able to subsidize some of those costs. In particular, Target and Walmart have come out recently saying that they're not going to raise their prices as much as inflation would indicate they should.
Are you mostly done with your Christmas shopping? You're an early shopper, right?
Normally, yes. I have the majority of the small things done. And the rest of it, I'm actually taking a moment to reassess whether or not I really need it. Because I think one of the things that will come out of this is some possible changes to our consumption habits. I'm hoping that we spend a little less. I'm hoping that we spend on local or regional products. And I'm hoping that we decide to spend a little more on experiences versus products themselves.
Erica Marciak, thank you for sharing your insights with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you very much for having me.
Erica Marciak is an associate professor of supply chain management at Old Dominion University. My next guest has been testing toys for safety. Stefan Dumas is an engineering professor at Virginia Tech. From the 1990s to the early 2000s, he conducted a long-term research project for the military, looking at ways to prevent face and eye injuries. After publishing his findings, he started to get calls from popular toy companies. Ever since, Stefan Dumas has helped toy companies like Nerf and Hasbro ensure their toys are safe for children. Stefan, you and your team are testing the safety of toys, especially for eye injuries. What started you off on toys?
For the military, we did a lot of work looking at eye injuries for soldiers relative to blast loading and fragments coming at them. So we developed the skills and the science behind understanding eye injuries at a very detailed level. And then we got a call from some of the companies asking questions about how do we know if our toys are going to be safe for kids? How do we measure this? How do we put science and engineering behind the toy design? Because at that point, toys and the little toy blaster guns and the Nerf darts and the little BBs, all of those became immensely popular. And so we were able to help them design these to reduce injury risk.
Were you surprised when you got your first call from a toy company saying, hey, could you test this for us?
I was surprised. You know, we get a lot of calls from different people. The first big company was Hasbro, and they do a lot of great research on all their products. And so we've been able to work with them closely. They were interested in how to quantify risk for the little Nerf darts, eye injury risk, and the Nerf darts and all the competitor darts, and really working with all of the industry to set standards based on the technology we had developed.
It's so interesting. It was Hasbro and Nerf, because when I think of Nerf, I immediately think nobody's going to get hurt or break the lamps. It's such a strong brand.
They do a great job of very carefully designing their products and working to make sure they're as safe as possible. And there's a whole other side of that equation, which is now there's fake Nerf darts and what we call knockoff darts, and they're not as safe. And so we've done a lot of analysis looking at those. And so we encourage parents, make sure you buy the Nerf branded product, because the knockoffs have much higher, almost three times higher risk of eye injury for kids. They're not built as carefully as the Nerf products are.
What are some differences, let's say, between Nerf darts that are safer and others that are less safe?
The basic thing is the Nerf darts are a little softer. And so the tip of the Nerf dart is designed to deform, whereas the knockoff ones are much more stiff. And so when it hits the eye, it's a higher force and higher eye injury risk. And it's amazing. If you go onto Amazon and type in Nerf dart, you're going to get pages and pages of knockoff darts. So parents really have to be careful to make sure they're buying the Nerf products, because I can tell you those are the ones that are designed better.
Have you found that the risk of injury from toys has risen because of Amazon?
Well, I couldn't say that, but I can say that there's a clear, definite three times increase in risk with the knockoff darts. And, you know, it's important that we get that message out, because especially this time of year when people are looking at holiday shopping, and, you know, these are very, very popular toys. And so we want to make sure the kids have the safest possible products.
What about the Nerf sword? What did you find with that? And how could a Nerf sword possibly be injurious, right?
Well, the Nerf swords, and there's a lot of different types. Again, a great deal of engineering and background research went into those. We did a lot of research with little kid volunteers. The question was, well, how fast does a kid swing? And how fast does that vary between boys and girls and ages? So we mapped all that data so we can quantify exactly how old a kid is, whether they're a boy or a girl, how fast they swing, and what's the risk of getting hit in the head and then possibly having a concussion. So that was the background engineering. And then that led to the very soft swords, and they're very deformable. So even if you were accidentally to get hit in the head with them, they're very force limiting and very low risk of injury.
Your children are older now, but you used them for years, and I'm sure they were thrilled to be doing it, to watch them in the lab as they played and maybe record them on video to measure force and stroke, right?
Right. They've been wonderful participants. It's important to note that we do have IRB approval for all these different things that we do, because they're human subjects, so we're very careful to make sure we do that. But it's been fun, and they've loved it, because they get to see all the science and engineering that goes into these toys, and they're very popular toys.
What kind of toys have you tested that are really in the most dangerous category?
Well, there's a big jump when you start to talk about things like BB guns and paintball guns.
Right.
Those are extremely high, basically 100% guaranteed eye injury, severe eye injury, if you get hit with one of those in your eye. So we do the range of sports, from the very safe Nerf darts to the very unsafe paintball. And I love paintball. I like playing that. But that's an activity where you have to be very, very careful, and you have to wear, you know, full face protection to make sure you minimize the risk of eye injuries. Because if you don't, and one of those objects hits you in your eye, it's almost 100% you'll lose your eye.
I personally love drones and remote helicopter toys, and I've bought my share of those. But you have found that they are also some of the more dangerous toys in the market. That surprises me.
This is something that's very, very alarming. People don't understand that the drones that are flying around that you attach cameras to, if they contact you, they are going to hurt and they are going to cut your skin, and you've got to be very, very careful. Now, on the lower end, you have the smaller foam-based drones. One of the popular brands is AirHawg. And again, if you go to Target or Walmart, there's a whole aisle of these types of devices. They're meant to be flown inside your house. So those are what we really worry about, because those are the ones that kids are going to be flying around each other. They're actually going to fly it into themselves or their parents or their siblings. And so we do a lot of work on how do you design those blades so that when it does run into a kid, it's not going to cut them up.
I understand you're also working with the FAA on some guidelines for those drones you just talked about.
Right. We have a great partnership with the FAA, and our drone group here is a wonderful group of researchers. We have about 40 people working in drone delivery. We're actually lucky here at Virginia Tech. We have the first consumer drone delivery in the country, and it's active right now. They're flying drones, delivering coffee and snacks and candy. So what we want to do is make sure that that drone, if there ever was an accident and maybe it loses power or wind or something, that if it does come down and hit somebody, we want to make sure that that's not a dangerous injury.
I know there is that program for the drone delivery at Virginia Tech, and you mentioned the coffee, snacks, lunch, that kind of thing. Is that a very limited experiment, or are there drones everywhere in Blacksburg?
It's fairly limited because we have an airport in the middle of Blacksburg, so they can't get near that. And they've been doing this for a long time, and it's very successful. It's every day. They have about 20 different drones that take off and land, and people that have this system and enjoy the delivery really like it. It's wonderfully easy to have things land right in your front yard.
Is it as good as, let's say, Uber Eats?
Well, it's quicker.
Yeah.
And it's a better energy footprint. That's one of the driving things in terms of the environment. This is a less gas. These are all electric, and they're quicker and easier to get to your house than having to drive.
How pricey are they right now?
All the delivery that Wing is doing is free, so they're not charging the consumers. So that makes everyone very happy. So
yeah.
You can imagine. Long term, you know, they're looking at being competitive with like the prices of Uber. The cost can be dramatically less because they can fly. They don't need a driver. They don't need an automobile. The drones can get to people's houses quicker. They can go, you know, basically line of sight. They don't have to follow the roads. There's not congestion. So the potential for these to be very effective and cost efficient and better for the environment is very, very positive.
I know we're getting off track here, but it does scare me what people can also do with drones. I mean, cluttering up the airspace and possibly using them for nefarious reasons, right?
I agree with you. There's absolutely a lot of concern, and there's a lot, I mean, just a tremendous amount of research going on in that space. I mentioned we have about 40 active researchers just working on drones and drone safety and drone technology. It is a booming business. It's only going to get bigger. And that's why we have to work with the FAA and make sure we have the right policies and the right procedures so that we can do this safely. But it is a very dynamic time, and we want to make sure we have these right policies so that we can keep everyone as safe as possible.
What are some red flags that you think parents who are now busy shopping for toys for Christmas ought to be aware of from your research?
One of the biggest is these higher functioning drones. We're very concerned because there's such a dramatic proliferation of drones. They're almost everywhere. And we want to make sure that people understand there's training, there's ways to handle these safely. And if you do that, you'll be fine. But they're not simple toys.
Stephan Duma is the Harry C. Wyatt Professor of Engineering at Virginia Tech, and he's director of Virginia Tech's Institute for Critical Technology and Applied Sciences. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center researching and developing the treatments of tomorrow, uvahealth.com. Virginia Humanities has a new paid fellowship opportunity for humanities scholars affiliated with Virginia's historically Black colleges and universities. Selected candidates will be funded through a grant from the Dominion Energy Charitable Foundation. Applications are due by January 7. Please go to virginiahumanities.org. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Maya Neer and Cassandra Deering are interns. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in